And this is Eliana Elias, and this song is A Girl from Ipanema on KZSU.
Mais linda, mais cheia de graça, ela menina que vem e que passa, um doce balanço caminho do mar. Moça do corpo dourado, do sol de Ipanema, o seu balançar é mais que um poema e a coisa mais linda que eu já vi passar. Ah, por que estou tão sozinha? Ah, porque tudo é tão triste? A beleza que existe, a beleza que não é só minha, que também passa sozinha. Mas se ela soubesse que quando ela passa, o mundo sorrindo se enche de graça e fica mais lindo por causa do amor.
Classic bossa nova from Eliana Elias, and from this is from the album Eliana Elias Sings Jobim, and this is a track called A Girl from Ipanema. This is the selection chosen by our guest for the hour, Professor William B. Gould IV. Professor.
Kathy, nice so to nice to be here with you again, and to hear Eliana Elias. As I was telling you off mic here, I first discovered her myself about 16 years ago when I listened to on the jazz station in Washington, D.C., when I was serving there as chairman of the NLRB. I heard one of her things in the morning, and I found it so invigorating and exciting. In a way, that tune is illustrative of what I love of her. I've seen her here in the Bay Area both in San Jose at a little club catty corner across from the Roman Catholic Cathedral in San Jose, and then also at in San Francisco at some of the clubs there. Most of the people that I've selected jazz pieces for, I've seen at various times. And as I was telling you, I just got back from New York City, where my hosts, when I spoke at the St. John's Law School about baseball and my book Bargaining with Baseball, my hosts took me to the Village in Manhattan, and I went to the Jazz Standard and saw George Coleman, and playing a number of exquisite renditions, one of them being Good Bait, a fabulous tune that Cedar Walton does great things with, and we're going to hear a little bit from him as well. And then I went on to the Blue Note, where I heard Chick Corea on his 70th birthday. So I just feel as though, having come in on the plane from Manhattan yesterday, I feel as though I'm just kind of on the wings of wonderful jazz, and it's great to be with you, Kathy, again.
Well, it's nice to have you, Professor Gould. And you just came out with this new book, Bargaining with Baseball, Labor Relations in an Age of Prosperous Turmoil. And you can find this book from the McFarland, from the McFarland Publishing Company. And would you please talk about this book? And first of all, it starts off with of history about baseball, of course. And we want to ask you, why is, in your opinion, why is 1946 so important to your book On and Off the Field?
Well, 1946 was important at two different levels. First of all, it was the year, and I talk a little bit about this in the book, that I began to, as a kid, play sandlot ball on a very informal basis, no uniforms, no umpires, calling strikes. It was great for batters. One of the reasons I became great, very much interested in hitting. We didn't really have proper fields, no measurement. The measurements were the outfield was surrounded by a creek, and the outfielders were afraid to go beyond that. That was a home run. And I mentioned one of the ones that I hit, as well as some of my situations where I didn't do as well. But the big thing that happened in 46 was what we were reading about. We were playing the game every day that summer, and for about 4 years thereafter, morning and afternoon, our mothers would make sandwiches for us, and we'd ride down to the field, the station field in Long Branch, New Jersey, and we'd play every day. And then we were imbibing baseball. We were reading about it and listening to it on the radio. Nobody had television then, or except for the very rich people. So we didn't have television. We were listening to it on the radio. And the Boston Red Sox, my team that I feel eternally passionate about, broke into a big lead. I was very excited about that. But as I say in the book, there were three things happening off the field that were terribly important that summer. And really, in a way, those three things in 1946 affect everything in the book. First, Jackie Robinson. Jackie Robinson was signed by the Brooklyn Dodgers that year, and he played for the farm team, the Montreal team, Expos. The Montreal Royals. The Expos were the major league team later on, and he played for the Royals and did very well. I talk about how my father was not really very much interested in...
But he took you.
Yes,
he took... And your mother, too.
Yes, they took me to these games. My father had zero interest in baseball at that point. He had played some football in high school and college.
But how did you get this bug from your friends and the love of the game and just that passion to play?
Well, it's a funny thing. A group of us, and I've dedicated the book in part... to a lot of these guys, we just we just loved it. We played, we kind of fed off each other. We played it every day. We talked about it. And we'd talk about it when we'd eat our sandwiches in the middle of the day. And we'd play all from the morning till between 9 and 10 o'clock till about 4 or 5 in the afternoon. And
With no adult supervision. You just went out there with your friends.
Right. We drove a couple of miles on our bikes and went to this field that was right near the railroad tracks. And we had a great time. And that was, of course, the turning point for me, my personal involvement. Robinson was very excited. You know, my father, although he wasn't really interested in baseball, you know, my father, we're an African-American family, and he said that day when Robinson came up to the big leagues the year after, he said to me at the dinner table that night, "I hear Robinson knock one in today." And I looked at him, I said, "Robinson knocked one in? How do you know that?" And so we're very excited about that. And that had a big development. That was a big development that had an impact on things that we saw afterwards, and that I write about in this book. Second thing was that a lot of the guys, that was the year that everybody was coming back from the war.
Post-World War II.
Right. And all the big outstanding players, Ted Williams, the great Ted Williams, the greatest guy that I've ever seen play this game, last man to hit 400 in the major leagues. He was coming back. Joe DiMaggio, Stan Musial of the Cardinals. And but what was happening was that, and so it was very exciting for baseball, but a lot of these guys were being enticed to go to Mexico in the new Mexican League. And baseball tried to really boycott these guys, wouldn't let them come back. And so they sued, ultimately, in antitrust when baseball wouldn't let them come back because they had the audacity to go down to Mexico and play rather than to continue under the reserve clause where baseball said to the players, "Hey, you're ours for life. You can't play for our competitors."
And that was from the 1920s decision by Judge Holmes?
Yes,
is that right?
Well, Justice Holmes in 1922, in the federal baseball decision, landmark decision, had held that baseball was not an industry within the meaning of interstate commerce, and that therefore the antitrust laws, which would prohibit restrictions upon player mobility from club to club, did not apply. The antitrust laws did not apply because it was not within the meaning of the baseball was an exhibition, purely local, the Supreme Court said, not involving the flow of goods across state lines, even though the baseball games themselves, aside from the teams moving across state lines, the baseball games were being telegraphed even at that time. And then, of course, as I've said, at the time that I was a kid, the games were being showed on radio and television. The Court of Appeals for the Second Circuit issued a decision involving this Mexican League dispute, sort of indicating that maybe this 1922 federal baseball decision by Justice Holmes, who, like all law professors and baseball players, maybe had a bad day that day when he wrote the opinion, that maybe this was in question. So baseball, because it saw the handwriting on the wall, or thought they saw the handwriting on the wall, suddenly settled, really capitulated, with these players, Max Lanier, Mickey Owen, Danny Gardella, all these players who were being banned, Fred Martin, who were being banned when they are not allowed to return, and they settled with them, and we're playing along in the summer of 49, and suddenly we see all these guys coming into the league, and we say, who are these guys? Because they had left just before we started playing in June.
Uh-huh.
So that was a second big development that affected baseball for many many years to come. And then a third development that summer of 46, which I talk a little bit about in the book, was the attempt by the players that summer in 46 to establish a union. An NLRB lawyer, a lawyer for the National Labor Relations Board, which ultimately I became chairman of in the 1990s, named Robert Murphy, he tried to represent the players in forming a union. But he was unsuccessful. They thought that they would start first in Pittsburgh, where the Pittsburgh Pirates were playing, and really a Union-friendly town. But they didn't. They didn't reckon with the attitude of a pitcher on the Pirates named Rip Sewell, who threw the Euphus pitch, the blooper pitch, which was very confusing to hitters. Williams hit a home run off it in the 1946 All-Star game, and that I listened to on the radio with one of my pals from the station field. And Sewell said, no, we don't want a Union, and stopped it in its tracks. But the owners realized that pensions were very important to players because, you know, the career of a player is so abbreviated.
Shelf
so
life, right?
What's going to happen to them afterwards? So the owners started a pension system, and pretty soon the Union came back again and became very important in the 1960s, and much of the book is about that as well.
Exactly, and what I like about this book is it covers it all. From the inception of baseball, the history, and your love for the game, and of so much information. This is for somebody who loves baseball, and you definitely are a wonderful person to chronicle all the information. Again, I'm with Professor William B. Gould IV. His latest book is called Bargaining with Baseball, Labor Relations in an Age of Prosperous Turmoil. And again, this is from the McFarland Publishing Company. And Professor Gould, would you like to go to a song, or should we talk?
Sure. Okay. Why don't we
Professor Gould, you always bring such amazing music. So we're going to go to a musical break. This is a selection chosen by Professor Gould. This is Cedars Blues. This is from the Timeless All-Stars. Would you like to talk about?
Well, the Timeless All-Stars are a great group of guys that I saw a few times in the 1980s. Cedar Walton, who's still around, you know, and plays exquisite piano, and you can see him often in places like Yoshi's. Buster Williams on bass, Billy Higgins, the late Billy Higgins, on drums, Bobby Hutcherson on the vibes, and Harold Land with his deep tenor sax, a little fellow, not physically imposing, and who's no longer with us. He was much older than these other guys, playing this deep, powerful tenor sax, and I love these guys.
Oh, well, this is exciting. Okay, let's take a listen to it. Cedars Blues on KZSU. Okay, and that is Cedars, a Taste of Cedars Blues. That is from the Timeless All-Stars, and this is a track that was chosen by our guest in the studio, who is Professor William B. Gould IV. He was the chairman of the National Labor Relations Board from 1994 through 1998. He's a professor here at Stanford Emeritus at Stanford Law School, and we're talking about his latest book, which is called Bargaining with Baseball, Labor Relations in an Age of Prosperous Turmoil, and you can find this from the McFarland Publishing Company from them. And Professor Gould, that was a beautiful song. Thank you for choosing that.
I just wish the CD had been in a little better shape. I'm not taking enough good of care of my CDs.
Oh, that's fine. I guess Kathy, the CD just skipped, and we just took the opportunity to talk about. You know, you were the chairman of the National Labor Relations Board during the biggest strike in baseball from 1994 through 1995. And would you please tell us about the role of law in baseball as set forth in Bargaining with Baseball in your book?
Yes. Well, Kathy, as you can see from what I said earlier, antitrust law, notwithstanding its obvious applicability to professional sports, didn't apply, even today, in part, doesn't apply to baseball, given the 1922 ruling. But labor law, therefore, became very important. The players and the owners had a series of disputes beginning in the middle of the 70s, arising principally out of free agency, which an arbitrator chosen by both the players and the owners held was properly the right of the players to be free agents, to go from one club to another after they played out their contract. There are tremendous disputes about this decision in 1975. Every time the collective bargaining agreement negotiated between the union and the owners expired, there was a strike or a lockout, really beginning in 1972 in a strike over pensions, until we got to Washington. I got to Washington as chairman of the labor board.
And I'm sorry for interrupting, but you were appointed by President Clinton for that position, and you thought that you would have nothing to do with baseball.
Right, right. I said to my pals around here, the only thing that's troublesome about this appointment is that, I had become involved in baseball with the salary arbitrations in the early 90s, and I said, too bad, that's the only downside. And one of my pals here, the late Leonard Coppett from used to teach a seminar with me at the law school on sports law, a seminar that still goes on to this day, he said, listen, you'll be more involved than you ever were. And truer words were never spoken, because what happened was the players and the owners in the summer of 94, shortly after my appointment, got involved in the mother of all strikes. It started in August of 94. It continued. The World Series was canceled for the first time since 1904. Only two World Series have been canceled, 1904 and 1994. And next spring, the parties were still at loggerheads, unable to resolve their differences. We decided at the labor board in Washington that the owners had engaged in unfair labor practices, had unilaterally changed certain conditions of employment. We went into federal district court to get an injunction before Judge, as she was then, Sotomayor. Judge, she's now a justice on the Supreme Court. And Justice Sotomayor agreed with us, granted us the injunction. The players then returned to the field, ending the strike, and the owners accepted them. They've had peace and prosperity ever since, for 16 years.
And ironically, I mean, the owners were so worried about the pot not being able to grow, but it went from, I believe you mentioned it in your book, from $1 billion to...
to more than 7 billion now. It's increased almost sevenfold in the interim period. I think this is true for a number of reasons. One is the parties had really stared into the abyss. I mean, 1994, 95, so many baseball fans and the public were just infuriated with them. These two rich kids, you know, fighting with one another. And, you know, they were being deprived of baseball. President Clinton said to me at the White House, if you guys could solve this matter, the public would make me president for life. And so we went ahead with the case and got it resolved. And I think the other reason that the revenue has increased so much is the new technological breakthroughs, the internet, you know, I talk about the fact that when I was in London in the early 60s as a young student at the London School of Economics, my father used to mail the clippings of the standings to me. The Red Sox were doing very well that year of 1963, and I would run down to Charing Cross Station to get the International Herald Tribune, which would give me the scores a day or so late. And now, when I'm there, I can go into a sports bar and see the Red Sox playing big games on television downtown London. So the opportunity for income has changed so dramatically for baseball in that period, and they've done a number of things to improve themselves, in part through globalization, the fortunes of baseball look dramatically different today in 2011. They're about to settle on a new collective bargaining agreement tomorrow that will be very important in resolving their differences.
And what are the issues at stake?
Well, there are a number of things. I think there are three principal areas that this collective bargaining agreement covers. For the first time, it seems as though a major professional sport in North America will regulate and prohibit human growth hormone drugs. You know, this is remarkable because baseball, in the wake of our involvement in 1994-95, really turned a blind eye towards steroids. And even though it was obvious that people like Bonds, Clemens, McGuire, their physical shape it had changed so enormously that the records really didn't mean much in the late 90s and the early 21st century, at least comparing them to the records before. So now baseball has engaged in a kind of role reversal, whereas they were the last to get on board in dealing with steroids, they seem to be the first to be willing to take on HGH, and they're going to engage in some blood testing. Whether it's enough or not, we'll see, okay, for HGH. And there are a couple of other changes that they've made as well.
And what I like about this is I had no idea about this until I read your book, and I didn't realize that HGH there's no policy to have it tested.
Right.
So tomorrow's decision is it's very timely. And
the agreement tomorrow that should be announced tomorrow, Tuesday or Wednesday, is terribly important
for the
public
season.
Yes, yes, mm-hmm. Right. And football has tried to, said they were going to do something about HGH, but they really haven't done as much as they should, and they really haven't gotten HGH testing off the ground yet. They're in a back and forth with Congress about this, just as baseball was in a back and forth with Congress in 2005, 2006 on the steroids issue.
That's interesting. And this is a chapter in Professor Gould's latest book. It's called Bargaining with Baseball, Labor Relations in an Age of Prosperous Turmoil, from McFarland Books. And Professor Gould, would you like to introduce, we're going to take a short musical break, or would you like to talk about the selection you chose?
Well, the next one, I think, here, if I'm right in recollecting, is Ernestine Anderson, who I just love her. I've been in small nightclubs where she's sung here in San Francisco, and seen her up at the Fairmont, where she belts it out, singing of how she's been to Rome and Tokyo and she's done this and that. Ernestine Anderson, one of my favorite jazz singers, so I'm just delighted that we could include her today.
Great. And here's the song by Ernestine Anderson, chosen by our guest, Professor William B. Gould. And the song is Someone Else is Steppin' In on KZSU.
He came home this morning, oh, what a shock.
Ernestine Al Anderson, and this is a selection. The track is called Someone Else is Stepping In. Professor William B. Gould is our guest for the hour. And why did you choose that? Could you tell us about the
Well, I just love Ernestine so much, but also on this particular record, she's surrounded with such good people. Ray Brown on bass, Gene Harris on piano. We played a little, last time I was here, we did a little bit of Gene Harris. Red Holloway on tenor sax. You know, I mean, like his refrain is kind of Bill Doggett. Da 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 da. Wonderful, wonderful stuff.
That's, thank you so much for bringing this beautiful music. And Professor William B. Gould is the author of Bargaining with Baseball, Labor Relations in an Age of Prosperous Turmoil, from the McFarland Publishing Company. And speaking of baseball, would you please tell us about how the legacy of Jackie Robinson and your role in Jackie Robinson Day?
Well, Robinson, of course, came to the major leagues in 1947. He was not the first black player to play in Major League Baseball. A number had played in the 1880s, and they were driven out and not allowed to play. And, of course, also we have to say that, as my father used to say to me when I was a kid, there were probably a number of black players who played in the major leagues who were called American Indian, Native American, and who were from Latin America. Cincinnati had a very good pitcher in the 1920s from Cuba, who by North American standards would be regarded as black. But there was nobody who was identified as black until Jackie Robinson came along in 47. Only a few of the good players could play in his wake. In the book, I talk about how the average batting average for black players was about 290 in the years after Robinson. The white players was 260. So you had the very elite black players playing. You had an increase in the number of black players in the 1970s, but then gradually a decrease. And to the extent that we have gone down to the lowest percentage for black American players in the major leagues since the 1970s, when people began to keep track of this on a detailed basis. We didn't have a black manager until in the big leagues until 1975, until Frank Robinson was appointed as a player manager, like Bill Russell was appointed as a player coach by the Boston Celtics. The first black managers or coaches in the case of basketball were often players as well as managers.
And they rose the ranks.
They rose, yes, they had risen in the ranks of players, and gradually we've had some improvement, not nearly enough.
In the positions of third baseman, bench coach, and that
right.
is usually a shoe-in for the manager.
Right, right. Although now, this very year, subsequent to the publication of my book, we're looking at the fact that a number of whites were hired as manager who had no previous managing experience whatsoever and were not really on the track to be there, and they suddenly pop up as managers. And people like DeMarlo Hale, for instance, the Red Sox bench coach, hasn't been, so far as I'm aware, even interviewed by a leading team. Well, one of the things that baseball has done is create a Jackie Robinson Day to commemorate the day that on April 15, they'll do it again this year, when Robinson first played for the Dodgers in 1947.
They were in New York, the Brooklyn Dodgers.
Brooklyn Dodgers, right, right. Yes, I have to remember that, Kathy, because people, ever since 1958, of course, they've been the Los Angeles Dodgers. They were the Brooklyn Dodgers, and I've always been, you know, my sons who were raised here in the Bay Area, they said, well, how can you be so supportive of the Dodgers? Well, I said, look at the black players who came there in the late 40s and the 50s, Jackie Robinson, Dan Bankhead, Don Newcomb, and Roy Campanella, whom I loved so much, who was just an outstanding, one of the greatest catchers ever to play in the game. Well, now they're commemorating April 15 as Jackie Robinson Day, and I had the honor to be able to throw out the first pitch 5 years ago in Fenway.
And there's a picture of you doing that in your book.
Yes, yes, there is. It was a great day because what the Red Sox did in 2006 was to honor my great-grandfather, like Robinson, was somebody who rose up against great odds and great challenges. I wrote a book about him a few years back called
Diary.
He was
the first African-American sailor in United States history.
Well, not the first one, but one of the early ones. He was one of the, I think what makes him so different and special is that he is the first in this period of time when blacks were beginning to come into the United States Navy in 1862 during the Civil War. He kept a diary between 1862 and 1865. And 5 years ago, I donated this diary, which I had written this book about a few years prior, to the Massachusetts Historical Society. And so the Red Sox honored him at that time and had his photo on the scoreboard during the Jackie Robinson ceremonies and behind me as I threw the pitch that day. So that was a very special day for me, and I think that in some ways Major League Baseball has come forward since 1947 in some ways with the decline of black players, the insufficient hiring of blacks in the upper echelons, it hasn't.
From management, and you discuss that in your book, as well as many other topics about globalization and racism, and also you do bring up something about why maybe African Americans are not young African American youths aren't playing more baseball today.
Yes, yeah, I think that there are a number of reasons why. There is a decline in black players. Of course, first of all, we have to recognize that there are more players coming from Latin America, sort of some tension and controversy about this between black Americans and some of the Latin players. But the other thing that another thing that's very important is that, and I quote Mark Marcus, the coach of Stanford baseball, on this, that the NCAA rules are set up so that young blacks who are not economically in good shape and who need that full-time scholarship are going to go to King football or basketball because they're the sports that offer full scholarships. They have, I think, something like 80 scholarships here at Stanford and elsewhere in the NCAA Division I teams for guys who play football. Baseball, because the scholarships are so few,
and they're partial. They're partial
well. Scholarships because they're so few to parcel out. And the colleges have become, this is another one of the big changes that I discuss in the book, the colleges have kind of replaced much of the minor leagues, which have declined since I was a kid, as the new minor league for Major League Baseball today. A team like Stanford is going to be where Major League scouts are going to look. Well, if these kids are off playing football and basketball, there's no chance for them to expose their capabilities to Major League Baseball. We're going to have a situation where we're not going to be able to really address this unless there is more parity in scholarships between baseball and the other sports.
And you mentioned that Stanford's baseball program is one of the top.
Yes,
in the nation,
right.
And to hear that from the representative, the gentleman from Stanford baseball, that was very powerful.
Yes, well, Coach Marcus is very concerned about this, and he's a good friend, and he is very much committed to equal employment opportunity. Coach Marcus is quoted in the book on this.
Thank you. Yes, definitely. That is, he did have a quote in the book. And again, we're with Professor William B. Gould. We're talking about his book, Bargaining with Baseball, Labor Relations in an Age of Prosperous Turmoil. And we want to also, we're running out of time, I guess time flies. So would you like to talk about like globalization, or we should talk about...
Why don't we talk about another one of these jazz tunes here
such amazing music. We could play something from...
Another one of Eliana Elias would be terrific.
Okay, and this is a classic track. Why did you choose this track?
Well, it's such a joyous track. It's such a pick-me-up track. You know, the one we heard earlier, the girl from Ipanema, I love also, very low-key, very sultry, very sensuous. This is just
a beautiful song, classic.
Great, joyous.
And this is A Felicidade on KZSU, the lunch special.
Feliz.
Elias, and that is A Felicidade. And that is a track chosen by our guest, Professor William B. Gould, emeritus at the Stanford Law School. His latest book is Bargaining with Baseball, Labor Relations in an Age of Prosperous Turmoil. And Professor Gould, in the few short minutes that we have, I was wondering if I can fit in a question about baseball and globalization of the sport.
Yes, so I'd be glad to talk about that, Kathy. The globalization, of course, is something that has really emerged in baseball in two ways. We have more players coming from foreign countries, particularly Latin America. And, of course, that's the tie-in, another tie-in with Eliana Elias. Also, the Far East, Japan has... played great baseball. We have a World Baseball Classic that has been developed in recent years, where Japan and Korea have been had outstanding teams. Now, I mentioned the new collective bargaining agreement between the parties that'll be announced tomorrow. They will have a an agreement which will make the players. Drafted, some of the foreign players will be part of the draft system. They have been free agents before, except the players from Japan, where Japan has a special posting system. That's where most of the outstanding players come from Japan to the United States. And I talk about that.
In your book,
yes,
definitely,
yeah.
Because there was this issue about the Japanese labor lawyers being worried that there comes a great talent would just go right to America.
Right, right. There is a great concern about this in Japan. There has been declining attendance in baseball in Japan, but Japan traditionally, and I think I say this in the book, is in many ways more baseball crazy than the United States. I talk about how when we were kids, we would do our pitching motions and hitting motions in our living rooms and all kinds of places. And you go into the subway in Tokyo. I spent a lot of time over there writing a book about Japan and the United States, and you see the kids going into their imaginary stretches checking the runner at first base. And it's a wonderful, wonderful thing to say. So Japan is like the United States. Really crazy about baseball.
And so labor, how is that affecting baseball today?
Well,
the globalization.
The more players are being recruited. Japan is trying to work out new revisions to the so-called protocol with the United States. There's also a protocol with Korea. Very good players in Korea. Players are coming from Australia. And, of course, what this is doing is creating simultaneously great opportunities for Major League Baseball, because they can sell paraphernalia in all these countries. You know, they're looking for players in China now, new players, and they advertise and
to open
sell.
Up new markets.
Yes, right, right. So it's a question of marketing and more income and more games on television in those countries. My Japanese friends see a lot of the games that I see here in television. They just have to get up a little earlier in the morning sometimes, to see somebody like Ichiro play for the Seattle
Mariners.
Yes.
Yes, and that is the last chapter of your book, and which I really enjoyed. I think it's an exciting book for anybody who loves baseball or who doesn't know much about it and would love to know more about especially trivia and also history and the major strike, the biggest strike in baseball history, which you helped mediate and you cast the deciding vote for the injunction. And it's been a pleasure to have you. Thank you so much for coming in to talk to us about your book. Professor William B. Gould, who is the author of the book Bargaining with Baseball, Labor Relations in an Age of Prosperous Turmoil, from McFarland Publishers. Thank you so much, Professor.
Oh, thank you, Kathy. And I just want to close in saying that I have the photo of the book is dedicated also to my four grandchildren. And
William
I have
B. Gould the sixth.
Yeah, William
B. Gould the sixth.
And I have a photo of Joey, one of my older grandchildren, after crossing the plate home run.
He's doing great.
I don't know whether we have time to, on that note, go out with Horace Silver's hard bop grandpop, because that's the way I see myself these days, Kathy.
Grandfather.
A hard bop grandpa.
Grandfather of many great sluggers to come. Thank you very much for tuning in to the KZSU's Lunch Special. Please stay tuned for Holt and Jackie, who will be doing a five-hour marathon of electronic music. Electronic Groove is Holt's show every single Monday, 1 to 3 p.m. on KZSU. ¶¶